Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. I am Reggie Darden, and today I am super excited and at a loss for words that I have Ed Parker Jr. With me today. I'm just super excited and overjoyed to have such a distinguished guest. So thank you so much for taking the time to be on with me, and we're gonna chat some Kenpo and whatever else we decide to talk about today.
Sounds good.
All right. So typically the show, I go over people's journey in the martial arts and in Kenpo, but I think the listeners are fairly familiar with who you are and how you got started. I mean, we'll probably touch on that some, but I don't think that we probably need to spend a lot of time going into that. I usually start off these episodes by just kind of giving the guest my background. So
sure,
I'll go ahead and fill you in on that. So I started Kenpo. Well, let me go back a little bit further. I've always been involved in the martial art, or always been a fan of the martial arts, and grew up watching the Jackie Chan movies and the Bruce Lee movies and Black Belt Theater and Kung Fu Theater back in the day. And so I always had a love for martial arts, but didn't get to actually start it until my teenage years. I can't verify this, but the story was that my father was a bodyguard for Muhammad Ali for a period, and at the time, martial arts were just getting popular in the United States, and he said that the other guys that he was working with were talking about, oh well, I can do this karate thing, and I can rip out a guy's heart before, and show it to him before he dies, and silly things like that. So he always had it in his head that, the martial arts were this, deadly thing, and was all about killing, and so he would never.
Yeah, that would be referred to as murder.
yeah. Yeah, I don't think people would pay to learn how to murder people. So, so he never let me train, but I spent about 14-15 years wearing him down, and he finally let me sign up for a Kenpo class, and I was drawn to Kenpo because of the movie The Perfect Weapon with Jeff Speakman. And uh-huh. As we were recording today, I actually just spoke with him a little bit ago. So, I guess bucket list, or not sure what term to use at the moment. But yeah, this has been a very exciting day. But yeah, I saw The Perfect Weapon and saw that, what are they doing? They're doing Kenpo. So, me and my buddy, we found a school and, jumped right in. And I trained, at that school. I'm from San Diego, California, and, trained at a school that was, under the Tracy lineage.
Sure.
And did that for about 2-3 years. Got about halfway to my third brown when I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I got to do a little bit of Taekwondo and some Hapkido and some boxing. And got out of the military and did not move back to San Diego, ended up moving to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and just couldn't find a school that I really liked. So I kind of just did my own thing, tried to, kind of train with what I could remember, and Did that for a little bit until I found my other core system or core love, and that is of capoeira. And
I just got
involved with that. Also drawn to it because of a movie, Only the Strong, with Mark Dacascos. For those that may not be familiar with it, it is the capoeira movie.
Cool.
And so just fell in love with that, and I've been doing capoeira for coming up on 17 years now. And I was really, really enjoying that. But over all the years, I still kept my love for Kenpo. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I searched for a Kenpo school, and I found one that suited my needs, and I've been training there. I am once again a green belt, and this time working my way to that coveted black belt, and just enjoying the journey along the way.
Cool.
Also recently started the instructor program at my school, so excited to one day teaching Kenpo. During my capoeira days, I did kind of inherit the school, the group that I was a part of, and so I do have some experience with teaching, but not on the Kenpo side of that. So okay. I'm just looking forward to that and what comes next. But so that's kind of the brief rundown of my background. I've had some experience with some other arts, but Kenpo and capoeira, those have been my two main systems. So
that's awesome.
So I mean, obviously, with with your father being who he is, I would assume that it was probably kind of always a given that you were gonna potentially follow in his footsteps. I guess I should ask, was that something that was maybe expected of you, or was it something you were interested in, or maybe just kind of what are your thoughts?
I think there's a lot of assumption, but that really wasn't how it was. There were two families that our family and another family was a martial arts family, and then my dad, and that family, my father saw them, and the father said that they had to take Kenpo, and my father said, you take Kenpo, and if it's for you, stick with it, and if it's not for you, you can find another talent or interest that you want to invest in. And what he'd do is he did that about like once a year, where he'd have us start at the studio, and if we it didn't work for us, and we left, and then he tried again another year later, and it repeated that way for a number of years. And I personally didn't get involved into Kenpo until I was in my 20s. My love and my passion was for art. And so, you can only serve one master at a time. And my sisters were really into music, so they would practice and make that work. And I was into art, and I was kind of an adrenaline junkie. So I did rock climbing and cycling and, just things that I didn't really adhere to the team competition thing, or the one-on-one competition thing. I was always believed that your competition was with yourself, making yourself better, making yourself stronger, making yourself more agile, and competing against your old self, by staying fit. And so I was really heavily into rock climbing and stuff, and the family business was martial arts, so we stayed heavily involved with my dad's karate tournament, where it took us about 6 months to prepare for it. So we spent 6 months out of the year working on the karate tournament, getting that prepared for production.
And then I went to college to pursue artwork. I did a mission, a service mission for my church for a couple of years. And when those were done is when I started to train under my dad. So my young 20s, I started to train under him directly.
Okay. Now, as you know, I think it's good that, you know, you weren't, you know, forced to, you know, to be a part of it, you know, or you were, you know, always given that option. But, you know, did you ever kind of feel any pressure, maybe even though it wasn't, you know, explicitly, you know, said, was there ever the kind of that feeling like, oh, like maybe I should be doing
this?
No,
actually, my dad was a really great father. And, you know, there's always this hope, you know, all parents hope that their kids will, you know, gravitate towards their passions and towards their, you know, their careers and stuff. But I didn't have that. And my dad didn't encourage that. The way he looked at my life was that he saw the talents that I had, and he tried to figure out how can I use my son's talents for my industry. And so I started to study Kenpo to understand what he needed artistically in conveying his book series and stuff like that. So I really got to know Kenpo at the beginning to know how to illustrate and convey my dad's ideas and thoughts. And it's through that I became interested in his mind and in his art. But, you know, martial arts was very embryonic when I was growing up. There were no other kids. It wasn't, you know, at least in my dad's studio, there were no kids. And I had four sisters, and two were way too young at the time I started at the beginning. But there was no kids programs, and it wasn't really structured for kids. So it wasn't something that was fun. And usually the people that taught martial arts back in those days, they were bill collectors during the day, and then they took Kenpo at night. So it's not like they were really structured to know how to interact with kids. So it's kind of funny. I was told that if I took an hour class that I would get a chocolate soda when I was done. So that was the only thing I cared about, was that chocolate soda, because the way that I was taught was, you know, it was supposed to be an hour class, but it was a 2-hour class, and it was just on footwork, specifically drag steps. So, you know, for a kid to do 2 hours of drag steps, it isn't fun, you know, and you got a guy who's kind of bitter because he doesn't know how to deal with kids. So he's looking at it like, I got to babysit the old man's kids. So he's bitter, he's angry, he's teaching kids, he's hating it. And you know, I mean, I'm friends with this guy now, and I had a talk with him about it. And I said, so you weren't really into kids, were you? He goes, I hated them. I said, well, them was me, you know, so you hated me. I said, that's okay, it was mutual. I said, I didn't like you either. So I said, I mean, come on, dude, you made me do 2 hours of step drags. He goes, I wouldn't have made you do 2 hours if you got it right. And I said, the problem is that you guys are insecure, and you feel like you have to make the son of Ed Parker be a black belt in his first lesson.
Yeah.
So they weren't prepared from the adult Ed Jr. to come back at them years later. But I did. And, you know, I just, you know, but everybody's ignorant at the time. Nobody knows what they're doing. Martial arts is brand new. They thought it was some kind of a Mexican dish, you know, to yeah. eat at a restaurant. You know, they didn't know what it was. And there was judo, and, you know, in the magazines at the time, it was all about the what do they call that thing? It was like the Charles Atlas program, you know. It was like learning how to beat up the bully type of thing. But it was all judo based. And you know, when your father begins something, in fact, his very first ad that he put in the paper in Pasadena, California, when he opened up a school, it said karate instructor needed, no experience necessary, because there was no other karate instructors. So my dad had a program where he made sure that the instructor had two lessons above the one they were teaching. So
that's wild.
And three of those people wound up becoming 10th degrees in my dad's art. So it's pretty impressive what happened.
Do you think if the times were different, if being the position that your father is in now, do you think if you were kind of coming up with the way things are today, do you think you would have maybe had a different path? Or
of course, I mean, my dad was a progressive. Every 10 years he evolved into something, and his students, the way that they look, you can't fault anybody for being who they are. They're going to take what they take as an educational understanding, and they're going to apply what means something to them. And the reason why I'm saying it that way is there are certain people that learned Kenpo in the 60s. They still teach that version of Kenpo from the 60s. And then there's ones that learn from the 70s, and they still teach that version from the 70s. So my dad was a progressive, but inherently people are either progressives or they're traditionalists. And they'll take something that was taught to them in their era and they'll traditionalize it. And that's it. They don't progress, which is not, there's nothing wrong or right about it. It just is. It's kind of like saying, there are left-handed people or right-handed people. And then you can't go off saying, well, we should eliminate all left-handed people because that's just not right. People are going to be what they are, and they're going to do what they do, and they're going to grow from what they think is important. And, my dad wasn't rigid. He was a progressive. So he evolved. He had, I think it's six different Kenpo systems. He learned Chinese Kenpo, and then he developed American Kenpo from the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And he was developing the 90s version when he died. So, he just the way he was. And then if you take a look at his writings, he said, in the Zen of Kenpo, if you're doing Kenpo the same way, he says, how did he say that? He said, if you're doing Kenpo the same 10 years after my passing, you haven't done my art justice. So he was encouraging that, but there are people, they feel differently, and you can't fault them for that because that's what they know. That's what they know how to do. And some people are not that innovative. They're not that skilled to progress in art. They're not that intelligent. I mean, no disrespect, but there's a lot of, we used to have a joke about it. We used to say, well, you need a license to cut hair, but any idiot can teach you martial arts.
Yeah, no, that is very, very true. There's, there are so many people. So,
we don't have a regimented board, like a government board that is a standard for reaching, instructor status or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the martial arts industry is so fragile. And what happens is that there's a lot of people who I don't really want to go down this route, but there's a lot of people who exaggerate their past, exaggerate their training, and as a result, they have to protect it by making sure that people don't expose it. And so for whatever reason, people say certain things and do certain things within their training, and they wind up having to answer for it in the future. And so sometimes when people call them on it, they leave the organization and then they create their own one. And as long as whoever student is in the room is ethnically tied to some culture, they're international. So they might have five students. One's Japanese, one's Chinese, one's Filipino, one's black, I've got an international organization. So they start this movement with five students claiming they're international. So it's a mess. And I can't say that I'm It's not that I'm not happy about it. I just, you know, I wish things were different, but they're not. And so, you know, we have to take into consideration that there are a lot of fragile martial artists out there, and there are a lot of insecure people, and they present themselves kind of strangely at times. And I think maybe that's as far down that rabbit hole I want to go, because I don't really like talking negative about you know, the martial arts industry, but that's, you know, those are some of my thoughts. But, you know, it's shifting gears. I mean, my whole thing was, when my dad was a progressive and he went down different paths, one of the things that he did was, you know, he always tried to refine the material and make sure that things progress. And what made him do that is, when he saw Kenpo on film, meaning he saw himself, he recorded a 16 millimeter film of himself doing short form one. And when he did that, he played the film back, because the film, you could reverse it. So he saw his movement in reverse, and that's when he realized this concept, which was, for every action, there's an opposite and a reverse. And so he was really fascinated with that concept, and that's what made him evolve Chinese Kenpo to American Kenpo, is that he tried to make sure that there was no wasted time or space. So, like for instance, if you're doing short form one, you do the inward block with the right hand, but he wanted to make sure that you chambered your left hand back, but with purpose. So it was, he said, well, instead of just putting your arm back there, you should thrust your arm back there so that it's either a strike or it's a block. And so he made sure that there was always an opposite or a reverse focus on the material. And so he did, you know, a phenomenal amount of work and focus on making sure that he called it the fact that he didn't want it to be bathed in mysticism, where a lot of people would say, you know, oh, practice makes perfect. And my dad would say, well, perfect practice makes perfect. If you the basics, if you can't perfect the art itself, you can't refine that. And so you can't just keep practicing wrong and expect it to come out perfect. So he didn't leave it in the realm of mysticism, where a lot of people did. And they just say, oh, that's chi, or that's just part of, you know, studying it. Eventually you'll observe. And my dad's all like, no, that's not true. And he went down the path of science. And he taught me how to think like that, because when I started training with him, he said, I know my son can do this material, but the thing is I don't want my son to be a robot. I want my son to actually know how to think. So when he taught me my yellow belt class, you know, it lasted for like 2 years, something like that, you know. And the reason why is because he showed me all these variations. You can do, you know, a soft approach, you can do a hard approach, you can do a dislocate, you can do a, you know, you can do an extinguished situation, you know, just showed all the different variations. And so my training wasn't like, you know, the studios. I had more of the Mr. Miyagi approach.
Oops, yes, I was actually going to ask you about that, kind of a theme of that. So was there a kind of a separation between the training and life? Like, did your father like sneak in karate lessons while, you know, you're having a conversation, you know, at the park or something, you know, throwing the ball around, and it's like, oh, well, you know, do it this way so I can kind of secretly teach you Kenpo? Was there any of that, or was it, you know, just okay, training time and then, you know, lifetime?
It was all lifetime. He was always teaching, nonstop. There was never a throwing a ball, because that would mean that was the kind of dad he was. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. He was doing seminars or going to the karate studio or attending tournaments, stuff like that. I mean, that's what he did 24/7, you know, except for, you know, resting or whatever. So if you wanted to get to know Ed Parker Sr., you had to be a part of his world to be a part of his world. You know, there, you know, he didn't have a lot of time for anything else. And I had a dad that I wanted to be with. So he had a lot of wealth of knowledge. He didn't make it about, you know, jumping into a gi and bouncing around the floor, learning your basics. He made it about understanding how to think and how to solve things physically at times. And he was very philosophical and he was very humorous about a lot of things. And he used a lot of analogies and a lot of stories to help enlighten the mind. And, you know, I'm still hearing his stories, you know, 35 years after he's passed. He still echoes in my head and he makes sense now. You know, you can hear something from years and years ago and, you know, you might not get the full comprehension of it at the time, but it still stays with you. And then you think about it and you go, oh, that's what my dad meant. Or, oh, that's really cool. Or one of the things that got to me was the fact that, you know, he said for every movement, there's an opposite and a reverse. And that's what started me on my path. When my dad died, I was thinking about, you know, what was not discovered in Kenpo, how do you add to it? And so I went down that path. And, you know, the problem with Kenpo is that people like to believe that what they know is all there is to know. And so if my dad didn't teach it to them, then it has no value. And so there's a lot of insecurity in the arts. And so a lot of people weren't receptive to things, or they, you know, my dad was gone, so there was no more tether. And so then it was up to them to do what they felt like they needed to do. And they did. But I did the same thing. I went on a pursuit to understand what was the opposite. And to me, I completely get that Kenpo is great for a life after or a life or death situation. But I don't know how many people realize that in this world. Well, here's the philosophy my dad had that I'm completely against. And what that is, it is better to be tried by 12 people, you know, a jury of 12, than to be carried by 6 pallbearers. And I think that's an extremely romantic, you know, thought process. But it's not realistic, because my philosophy was, when you're rotting in jail for the rest of life is not when you come up with plan B. So to me, it makes a lot more sense that when you're training for life or death situations, that you realize that, you know, one size does not fit all. One fight does not fit, you know, one solution in a fight doesn't fit all fights. You know, what about drunk Uncle Bob? What about, you know, a handicapped member of the family? What about a drunk friend? You know, not everybody deserves leap of death, you know? Yeah,
exactly. And that actually, I'm glad that you brought that up for a couple of reasons. One, before I forget again, Peter Taz says hi. So throwing that out there, but that your story reminded me of that, of a story that he has told on his show about, you know, having to use a technique on, you know, a family member, and, you know, yeah, he decided not to go with the leap of death and went with something that's gonna, you know, take care of the situation like I said, with the least amount of force. So.
Well, you know, the thing is that there is an arrogant ignorance that's absorbed by certain martial artists, and they just think that they can solve all issues. And you know, my dad taught me to think more than that, think bigger than that. Because, you know, certain people say it's all in Kenpo. And I'm like, really? Why don't you come up and visit me in Oregon? And I'll take you for a walk. And I'll bring my 357 Magnum, and you can just bring your Kenpo. And we'll see when the bears come out who wins.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's not one size fits all. It's not Kenpo solves every situation. And the same thing is that, oh, let's go to a family reunion. and somebody gets out of hand in the family reunion, you can't go into a triggered response and expect to walk out of it, you know, the victor, because a lot of times you can go to jail from even handling things poorly in your family. Most people have to look at it like, what are we do as martial artists? We theorize about how we're going to be attacked, and we come up with solutions of how to get out of that circumstance. So the thing is that you have to open the spectrum, and you have to say, well, what are my circumstances? Are they, you know, are they all, you know, a guy with a ski mask in the alley with a knife? And so they all, you know, well, they say not every problem it requires a hammer as a solution. So it's kind of like the same thing. And so to me, it's like, I am all pro Kenpo, and I'm all pro the techniques that are there. And a lot of the techniques people have developed since my dad died, I'm all in favor of what they've done. But the thing is that, are we making more, you know, are we making a better gun? And because, to be honest with you, I can use a black powder rifle. It's not as accurate as you know, an AR-10. But the thing is that when that bullet hits you, it kills you. It might not be technically a savvy, but the bullet's a bullet. Mm-hmm. And death is death. You know, so the thing is that we can't solve everything with that same kind of tool. And so I think it is a matter of, you know, if to be the intelligent person, I think you have to really look at the spectrum of, why do we study self-defense to gain the edge? It's all about getting the odds in our favor. But the thing is that not all odds are going to be in that circumstance. Like, for instance, if there's a riot that breaks out, yeah, if you're caught up in the middle of it, use your Kenpo. But if you're in a situation where, you know, you're leaving your backside vulnerable and there are people with guns and knives and stuff like that, you know, the wisest self-defense is to leave the circumstance, you know, get out of there. You know, you can't put the odds in your favor in certain circumstances. And same thing with combat. You know, you might, you know, have a lot of skills in Kenpo, but if the other guy's lobbing grenades at you, you know,
exactly.
So you have to look at things micro and macro. You have to look at it microscopically and you know, from a telescope and a microscope. You have to look and see what fits, what doesn't fit. And that's what my thing was that I was noticing my dad's offspring, they were all trying to perfect the art of death. You know, it's like, we're the special forces of Kenpo, or we're the Kenpo elites, or, you know, and that's fine. That's great. You know, I'm not one to micromanage anything. You know, you just see what people do. I always looked at my circumstance as, you know, I like watching my dad's garden grow. I'm not there to weed it. I'm not there to prune it. I'm not there to influence it. I just watch it. And that's great. But I also believe in my own life. You know, I believe in what I believe in. I believe in what I want to do. And I went into self-defense after my dad died in a completely different direction based upon his thinking. He told me to look at opposites and reverses. And so when I looked at the situation, I'm going, okay, we have all these life or death techniques that are there. What about the control and restraint techniques? What about the material that gets you out of a situation with Drunk Uncle Bob or a bunch of kids that are getting out of hand? Or, you know, there's all these, you know, I can give you 1,000 ways that, you know, you could be in a situation where martial arts is not the answer. And so I started looking at martial arts from a macro perspective, and I'm going, okay, let's just say martial arts is a, you know, or self-defense is a cruise ship, and half the side of the ship is filled with martial artists. So, you know, let's just say they're all on the starboard side of the ship. So all these brilliant minds and all these talented people are on one side of the ship, but only that side of the ship. That ship is capsizing. Everybody's on that side. But if you take that same set of brilliant minds and talent and you balance them out to the other side of the ship, Yeah, the starboard side fellow martial artist. What do you put on the other side of the on the port side of the ship? And so that was where my mind went back in 1990. And I was actually entertaining a little bit before that too, but I talked to my dad about that. But the concept was that, and this is, you know, this is such a small amount of time to go into the depth of where my mind is at, but
yeah,
I'll try my best.
I hear you. I was actually looking at the time and I was like, oh, there's so many other things that I want to get to. And we will definitely, there's a couple of things I want to make sure that we touch on today, but yeah, we'll definitely have to do a part two and three and four to get to everything.
I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, I'm 65 years old, so it's not like there hasn't been like 65 years of memory and stuff that's gone on. But anyway, the reason why I'm going in that direction is because of what I'm currently involved in. And that is, and what I wanted to talk to you about was what I call the end game with American Kenpo out there. I don't know how many, we got over 100 10th degree black belts now. And I don't count them, but you know, those are the numbers I hear coming back at me. And when you, and then I asked the question, I said, well, how many of them are in their 40s? And a large number of them are in their 40s. So let's just do the math. If a person starts martial arts, say 15, they're 15 years old. So, you know, and they're 40 now and they're 10th degree. So, you know, we're talking 25 years on a mat. So 25 years later, they've gone from white belt to 10th degree black belt. That's great. So they progressed for 25 years. But if you've reached your end game at 40, where do you go for the next 25 years?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's my biggest issue with what's going on now with the progression. And that is I believe, you know, I mean, there's, it's great when you're in your 20s, you have all kinds of skills. We all talk about the golden years of when we were at our most fit or when we're at our most trim or when we're at our quickest or whatever. But you're going to lose that when you get older. But what do you gain when you get older? You gain wisdom. You gain a lot of wisdom. And we've seen it. It's projected in the movies, whether it's, you know, whether it's Mr. Miyagi or whether it's Master Po from the Kung Fu series. There's always this Hollywood version of the end game of what martial arts is supposed to contain. You know, an old man who has all these skills. He doesn't have this, you know, this youth on his side, but he has wisdom on their side and they can do these fantastic things. Well, that's what I was interested in my whole life long. I wanted to know what's behind the curtain. What's, you know, what's, you know, what are the mysteries? You know, I want to see it. And I saw all kinds of things. My journey led me to go into the back alleys of San Francisco Chinatown. And I saw some amazing things that, you know, I choose to keep private because sometimes even you talk about it going, you didn't see that. And so, you know, rather than evoke the negativity or the sarcasm, I'll just keep it private to myself. But I saw some amazing things. I saw some things that you never see in a commercial school ever. Never have, never will. But I saw some of the mysteries that you think or you hear about in Hollywood. I saw them. I witnessed them, and they're amazing things. So, you know, there are things that are past the commercial karate school. There are things that are taught in the back alleys of Chinatown. There are things that are taught in the mountains. And I spent a big chunk of my life doing that. And my, I don't know, maybe 25 my years after my dad died, I went looking around the world. I got to take seminars from all kinds of different people and stuff like that. And I was working on my own material when teaching. People asked me to teach, and you know, I treated everybody like a laboratory, and so you have volunteers that you can practice the theoretical ideas and put into practical application. And I found it fascinating. It was great stuff. But I found that what happened, and my dad and I were dealing with this at the beginning because we saw MMA come to light. And, you know, him and his students and myself, we'd sit around the TV and we'd analyze, or I'd listen to my dad analyze, and you know, we'd all have a different opinion about what we saw from the MMA stuff coming out. And what I found in time was that it became like the all meat buffet in my perspective. It was like everybody wanted to pick out like some of the deadly stuff from jiu-jitsu and or Brazilian jiu-jitsu and from boxing and from kempo or from you know wrestling or judo or whatever, and they pick all the meat out of this buffet, right? And so now it became a mixed martial arts thing. Before it was all about the loyalty and dedication to the cultural background of your art. So you know, if you studied Chinese martial arts, you did not cross train and do Japanese. That was forbidden. And so what happened is that changed, and people wanted to see, okay, let me extract this, or let me extract this, or let me extract that. And they started putting together this eclectic, you know, all meat buffet of the deadly stuff. But what happened was that there was no black belt involved in it. It was like, you learn it, you get in the octagon, and you show your massive skills, right? And then you get your butt kicked, and it's over. That's it. It's over. And so that was their end game. But the thing is that one of the things I noticed is if it was the all meat buffet, what'd you do with the vegetables? What'd you do with the desserts? And so my journey in martial arts for the past 30 something years was all about understanding the other stuff, you know, that was neglected, the philosophy, the wisdom, the stuff that, you know, you can get a guy into a finger lock with one finger and he's screaming for mercy. And yeah, I wanted for the heavy handed stuff. I wanted to know the nerve strikes, and I wanted to know certain things. And it eventually led me down to a path of discovering the other side or the opposite of martial arts. And if we go down that path of saying, you know, if there's an opposite of everything in this world, and I were to ask you, what's the opposite of martial? I ask people that all the time, and they would always say, well, that's peace. I said, no, that's the opposite of war. What's the opposite of martial? Well, I think we as a culture forgot to look for it. And I didn't invent it. I discovered it. And in that process of just, I started to extract things that I learned from different, you know, people from my world travels. And, you know, in time, it just turned into what we call the Paxual Arts. And the Paxual Arts to me is what is, you know, it's like what happens when you reach the end of your martial journey, Paxual Arts. But the way we look at it is Paxual Arts should be your beginning journey, martial arts should be your middle journey, and Paxual Arts should be your end journey. And so it's more like a sandwich, you know? So martial arts is the meat.
Yeah, no, I like that. I do want you to talk some more about the Paxual Arts there, but before we do that, I do also want to touch on your art. So as someone that cannot even draw a stick figure properly, I'm always blown away by anyone that can make some, you know, some art that is distinguishable. You can, you know, look at it and go, okay, I know what that is. And then, you know, your works are just really, really, truly amazing. So if you could just kind of just talk about, you know, when you started noticing that you had this creative ability and
well, I think we all do. Charlie Brown was out, and Snoopy would you know, imagine himself in a Sopwith Camel, which is a biplane from World War II. It was one of the British planes, And so it's easy to draw because it's, you know, when you draw it from the side, it's just a triangle with a little hole for the pilot. And then you draw two ovals for the wings, and then you do a cross, you know, for the wires, and a round circle for the wheels, and another triangle, and then a round circle in the back. And then, you know, for the most part, it looks like a Sopwith Camel. And I did stuff like that when I was a kid. But then what pushed me was that I saw that all the kids did it from side view, but did any kid do it where it hit the ground? So I did things like that, you know, where it was like it pushed the storytelling and drawing. Is that, you know, if you're going to have a plane crash, most of the time it's kids that had already done plane crashing, but they did the plane intact the same way, just diagonal in the ground. And I did a few cracked in half. And, you know, you draw a couple of squirrely lines to signify smoke. And I just like the idea of always drawing something that somebody else didn't draw. And, you know, I can't say I have any of those artwork. I think my wife found something from a while ago, but you lose things over your lifetime. But, you know, you just kind of go in different directions with artwork, and you just try to create something. And in time, you know, you hear people go, oh, I want to see that again, or I like that. And you like the feeling, so you stick with it because it gives you good feeling. People tell you that they like your creative ideas, or your the success that you had at conveying this concept. And so I started to do that, and then I started getting awards in school, and I got quite a number of awards. And I was always featured at, you know, school boards where they featured, you know, the young talent or whatever. So I started doing that. And my dad, you know, he didn't really care about stuff because I didn't draw what he wanted me to draw, because I didn't have that skill set. Like, he wanted me to draw a woman brushing her hair, and I didn't have that skill set. I didn't know how to draw hands. You know, people just assume that, you know, artists can draw anything, but you have to learn everything. Space between the bottom of the nose and the top of the lip, and, you know, do the corners of the lips, where they line up with the eyes, and, you know, where do the ears, you know, line up. And so you have to kind of figure all that stuff out. But I did, and I liked it. And partly the reason was I was the only boy, and my dad was gone a lot, always at a karate tournament, always at a seminar. And because he was, I was stuck in I used to call it my shark infested estrogen waters. You know, my mother was a very strong willed person, and so were my sisters. And the thing is that, you know, in our family, women had a committee, and if you were wrong by one, you're wrong by all. So, you know, so it's kind of like, that's just the way they were. And so there was no winning. If dad was home, he'd be on my side and he'd veto them. But when he was out of the house, and I'd be judged wrong no matter what, whether I was right or wrong. I was always outvoted. So what it did was it caused me to become a hermit. And I just buried myself in my bedroom. And my mom, she didn't like the way I was, because I was kind of a rambunctious kid, and I had a lot of energy, and I was adrenaline. I wanted to ride bikes and go this. And, you know, I remember I got in one of those little red wagon, those little radio flyer red wagons, and I went on top of our driveway, and I went down, and I got all beat up and hurt. But, you know, that's what you do as a kid, you know. You could have killed yourself. Yeah, but I didn't, and that was fun. But, I mean, as soon as my arm heals, you know. So I got grounded a lot, and then what would happen is that, you know, it allowed me my space to get into my never-never land, where, you know, nobody can harm you when you're in that place. You know, some people do that with music. They put on a set of headphones, or they, you know, like if they play the piano, they kind of tone out the world or whatever. That was just what I was able to do. I found this place where I wasn't allowed to listen to the radio. We didn't have TVs in our bedrooms. That was, you know, back in those days, you know, there was a TV in my mom and dad's bedroom and in the living room. And that was it. You know, you don't, our den. And, they, you know, nobody has, you know, TVs in their bedrooms other than my parents. So, you know, we had a transistor radio, and then I was grounded from my radio. So I just would go into my world and draw things. And I remember sent me, she had grounded me for a day or something like that. And so it was like 3 days later, she comes knocking on my door. You're not grounded anymore. I'm like, yeah, I know. She goes, what are you doing? I said, oh, nothing. Well, why don't you show me nothing? I'm not ready to show it to you. Well, what are you doing? I'm doing artwork. Well, you don't have to be grounded anymore. I know. Can you shut the door?
I love that. I love
And
that.
I think we all have that little escapism. I don't know anybody who hasn't. It just what did they choose to have that, you know, to do that? And then my mom took pride in that, and she started putting all my artwork in this hallway that was by my dad's office. And it was just filled with all the artwork that I did, or the ones that I got awards for. And people would come visit my dad. They go down that hallway and they, oh my gosh, who did this? Oh, my son. And he wouldn't have a lot of patience for that. So he didn't want them to stop and look. He goes, yeah, my son's into art, whatever. And so he just kind of, you know, bypassed my particular talent. And so one day I drew his portrait. And you never draw what somebody looks like, because that's called photography. You draw what they want to look like. You flatter the person. If they have a big nose, you tone it down. If they have small eyes, you make them a little bigger. If they have wrinkles, you take out the wrinkles. You know, you draw a person to flatter them. And I learned that at a very early age. And so I drew a picture of him, and he just fell in love with it. He goes, oh my gosh, this is exactly me. And I knew I lied. You know, in artwork, I knew I cut down, you know, certain things and enhanced other things. And he turned that into a poster and sold 50,000 of them.
Yeah, no, that's
Either
huge.
that,
That's very huge, yeah.
yeah, I used that money to go to college and to fund my mission. And,
Nice.
If you find success and you just keep doing it, I mean, it's no different than anybody who does like a tournament or something like that. You find that groove, and you're and it becomes, you know, it becomes a an adrenaline high for you, because you know you find this formula that works for you, and you get in a tournament. Next thing you know, you're winning first place left and right. You're collecting trophies. You want that. It's no different for me. You know, I was collecting kudos for artwork I did, and I liked it, you know. So you just keep doing it, and then you start taking art classes, and then you start learning how to draw hands and stuff. And then finally I got to a point where I was in college that I got to have that skill set. Then my dad, he came to me when I was in college, and he says, son, I had a dream. I think I'm gonna die, and I need to get my life's work done. Would you leave your college and come back and work with me? And that's what started that. And I already had a job working on a television show called Magnum PI,
Oh,
the original one, not the
yeah.
not the yeah.
Is
I
there
was
any
work.
other?
So I was working on that show, and then my dad, you know, he wanted me to come do that. And I was in charge of the graphics department at Brigham Young University Hawaii campus. So I had a career going. I was in college full time, and I left it all, and I came back, and I worked for him, and he couldn't pay me a lot at the time. And so, you know, it didn't matter. I was loyal to the bone to him. You know, he paid me very meager wage, and but it didn't matter. I worked 7 days a week. I worked sometimes, you know, a 24-hour shift, because we were deadline based. You know, he had a book series to get done, and we had to get it done in time to get it published and get it out by the karate tournament. So there was a lot of deadlines that we worked on, and it didn't matter. It was all about getting it done, you know, by a deadline. And so, you know, that's kind of where it went. And you know, that's I don't know, that history. But you know, going to what I've done currently, I think everybody has goals in their life of what they want to accomplish. Some people call it a bucket list. What do you want to do before you die? And one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to fully illustrate all of my dad's forms, techniques, and sets. So I've completed 167 illustrations since June, July, August, September, all this time. And then I see the value of doing artwork to help kind of unify, you know, the system. So I grew up with a family called the Castro family, and Ralph Castro died not that long ago. And he was in charge of the Shaolin Kempo system. But my dad and him were in the Coast Guard together. So we kind of grew up with the family as friends. So on my spare time, I did 40 illustrations of their forms. And I just completed that one last week. So that puts me up at 207 illustrations for Kempo. And, you know, I've got a few more sets to do. And who knows what I'll do next, you know. But, you know, my wife and I are heavily involved in the research. My wife does a lot of the, she's a educator, and she speaks fluent Mandarin, and she's smarter than I am. And it's a real joy. And then our son, Dacre, who lives in Taiwan, and his Taiwanese wife, they do all the translations for us. So all of the kanji is written by them, and then we embed it in the artwork so that it kind of pulls and gives, you know, a credence to the arts that we were influenced by, which is the Chinese side.
Very cool. Very cool. I like that. I can't wait to, or, well, I guess I should say, so are these illustrations going to be in like a book, or like kind of what's the plan?
No, we released the 10 forms out there, you know, short one, long one, all the way up to form 7. There's a form 8 I'm working on. I haven't finished that one yet. But the 10 that I did finish, they sold in August. And we still have a few left, but it was a huge hit. And they collected all over the world, everything from Germany to Australia to New Zealand. They're all over the place. It's been, you know, great to get that support. I have not released the 157 techniques yet. My wife and I are building a website. It's called, well, you can get it, but it goes right to our website, the art website. But, you know, I haven't made the Kempo side visual yet, meaning it's all built, but you can't see it. I just have to put more artwork in it and do the refinements, and that, you know, unfortunately you have to sleep in there.
Yeah.
Only so many hours sleep in the day.
Yeah,
there's only so many hours in the day.
I always say that there needs to be 40 hours a day, because I don't, you know, I want to train in all these arts and do this podcast and do all these other things.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I have a wife and two dogs that also want my attention, and it's like, there's not
grandchildren. We have 10 grandchildren and a boatload of kids, and and we just had to go to Arizona, and we married off our oldest granddaughter. You know, so we're flirting in the not too distant future with the title great grandparent. So, so that'll be interesting. But you know, I think that the great thing is that you gotta maintain your youth by being excited and, you know, always dedicated and motivated to get something accomplished. You know, to do something positive and to, you know, make people, you know, I think that Kempo has had all these names for techniques, but they never had a cover. You know, you can't buy a book without being enticed by the cover.
Exactly.
And in my career, I've done probably 500 book covers. And so I wanted to do, you know, like a book cover for all the techniques and forms. And, you know, I did that even for the Shaolin Kempo system. You know, and I think it helps, because I think that you as a business, if you run it, you know, and you have a bunch of artwork up on the wall, it intrigues people and go, I want to learn this system, or I want to learn this form, or I want to learn this technique. And the reason why I'm doing that is so that, you know, those who see something, they're curious, they want to learn it, they want to train, they want to get the, you know, it's a book cover. They want to see what's in the book. Mm-hmm. And so that was the concept. And it's working so far. So, you know, our website will be called theartofkenpo.com. And we bought the website already, but we haven't made it active yet. And, you know, hopefully in the next month or two, we'll make it active. But, you know, we go at a snail's pace with some of our projects because priority isn't as high. But we want to use that to fund our Paschal Arts, because our Paschal Arts is, we have international students all over the world, and we really like that. And we really appreciate who's on board. We have some phenomenally intelligent and talented people on board. And they catch the concept of what this is. You know, some people get it, some people don't. And we like working with the people who get it, and we're not interested in numbers because, you know, we're at a stage now where we're building our instructors. So when you build your instructors, you want to make sure that you get the cream of the crop and that you get a level of intelligence and you can be in a place where you use the collective mind instead of just the single mind, you know, to help formulate the whole thing, even though, you know, majority of this has already been written and presented by my wife and I. We have 144 lessons. We're on lesson 13 right now, and we'll get all the lessons done. And when it's done, then, you know, then it could be something that gets taught to the masses. But, you know, we don't want the pressure on us to teach the whole thing and travel, because my wife and I, we like the secluded life right now in our lives. I've traveled the world. I can't say I'm itching to continue to travel. I like being home. We live in a beautiful location where you can't see anybody. There's no street lights. There's no house lights. We live in the forest. You know, you can play your stereo as loud as you can, and nobody hears you, and it's nobody around. It's just,
yeah, that's the good life. That's definitely the good life.
Yeah, we live on a creek, and we do get snow. But the thing is that FedEx and UPS drops on our front porch, and you know, we know how to hunker down for the winter. So if we don't have to go out the door for a month, we don't.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so, gosh, like we mentioned, there's never, you know, not enough time in the day. So, you know, definitely want to get you back on to
sure.
cover some more stuff here, especially talk more about the Paschal Arts. But I think we'll go ahead and put a pin in that for now. We'll move to our lightning round, and then I'll let you go for the day. I just have kind of a few little fun little questions to get us closed out here. Navigating back to the Kenpo focus here. First question being, do you have a favorite technique?
Glance of fear.
Okay.
Nice. I know you never heard of it. It's the one my dad used to apply on me all the time.
Yeah, that's probably the most effective. I'm sure.
Yes.
Very nice. Very nice. Do you have a favorite form or set?
I don't know. I'm a really simple guy. I like blocking set one.
Hey, no, that's
I like it quite a bit. I've never been a kicker, never will be a kicker, and the older I get, the less I can kick. Yeah. So, you know, I'll leave that to the youth. I'm not so kicking set one is not necessarily one of my happy little tech sets. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, it's kind of hard to say what my favorite technique is, because yeah, I like five swords, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, one of the Kenpo All-Stars.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how can you, you know, I like seven swords. I like one sword and a poke.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great answer.
Yeah, I'm not a, what would you call it? I don't, you know, from my perspective, Kenpo is memorized poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's not how my dad was, and that's not how he raised me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I follow you there.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I've never been in the mainstream, never will be in the mainstream, and so all I can do is watch my dad's garden grow. I'm good with that.
Very nice. And then our final question, there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides your father, who would that be?
Living, I trained with all the ones I wanted to. All of them. Anybody who I ever wanted to train with, I did. With the exception of one guy, and he's dead, and that is Mikhail Robakov. I trained one of his top students, which is Vladimir Vasilius, in the art of Russian sistema. Mm-hmm. But Mikhail had died, so you know, I didn't get to train with him in this lifetime. But I like training in the Russian art. I like training in a lot of stuff. I like training in the Filipino arts and. So, but I would love to train with Chuang Tzu.
Not sure I'm familiar with with that name.
Mm-hmm. Hang on. I'll have my wife say it properly.
Chuang Tzu. It's Chuang Tzu. There was Sun Tzu who wrote Art of War, and Chuang Tzu, who wrote The Way, basically.
Okay.
They call it the Zhu Crew, which is one was Confucius, one was... you can explain it better.
There's Sun Tzu, Chuang Tzu, and Gong Tzu. And Sun Tzu wrote Art of War, and Chuang Tzu wrote The Way, and Gong Tzu was the one we know as Confucius. So they call him the Zhu Crew.
Okay.
Being that she's fluent in Mandarin, I like her to pronounce it better than I do.
Yeah, no, that sounds we know great. It as,
yeah, we know it as Sun Tzu, mm-hmm. but it's not pronounced that way. So, I would love to have studied under any of those. I would love to have studied under... why is it? I can't remember his name yet. I marveled at him. The Greek one, honey.
Oh, what, Socrates?
Socrates.
Yeah.
I would have loved to study Socrates. My dad was fascinated with Socrates. I would love to study the mind of Nikola Tesla. Mm-hmm. I would love to study the mind of Fibonacci. I would love to, you know, even in art, I'd love to have met Leonardo da Vinci, you know,
mm-hmm.
Gauguin, any of them, you know, because they understand anatomy, and we always discount artists as if they don't have any value in anatomy. And yet martial artists, they talk about anatomy a lot, but most of them have no clue what anatomy is about.
Mm.
They look at a couple of, you know, charts on a wall of acupressure and, you know, a couple of charts in a medical journal, and they think they know what they're talking about. But I had to study it in art school. I had to study everything. I had to understand what the major muscles of the body were. I had to memorize each one. I had to know which muscles went over it, what veins went over it, what nerves went over it, what the fat content is, how it grows, you know, the rotation of each joint, whether it was a hinge joint, a ball joint, you know, any of that stuff, socket joint. I studied all that stuff, and I've never seen martial artists, you know, not that there aren't out there, because I haven't met everyone, but for the most part, I haven't met people that have gone to extensive knowledge about the human anatomy. and you had to memorize it in an art school. It was definitely something that you had to know. And so to me, I encourage people to learn anatomy from an artistic perspective because it makes your martial arts better.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly with that. So, yeah, no, thank you for that.
Sure.
Okay, so yeah, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on with me and
sure,
just you know sharing your story. We're definitely gonna have to have you back to talk more about Paxil Arts. Definitely want to hear more about the Sistema. I would be curious to hear more about that. So we'll definitely have to make a note to chat about that next time. But yeah, no, thank you so much. Now is your time to give any plugs or say anything that you might wanted to mention before we close out. And now is your time to say whatever you'd like.
Well, if you want to check out my wife's photography or my artwork, go to EDAND. My wife's name is Bear, BAER. So it's Ed and Bear Parker Art.com. Check out some of our work. If you're intrigued by any of the Paxil Arts material that we've been talking about, you can go to PAXTIALARTS.com, PaxilArts.com. There's some great articles on there, and you can see, some of the things. We have one free lesson on there that you can look at. Look out for it in a couple of months. We'll have theartofkempo.com and release hundreds of pieces of artwork that'll come out on that. And we'd love your support on that because it helps fund our other projects. Artwork is the staple for us, and as long as people, are kind and supportive of our projects, then we can continue to do our projects, until our last breath, which, that's what we do. But it's been an honor and a pleasure being able to talk with you and meet you. And we thank you for your time and for the service that you do in keeping the Art of Kempo alive and the curiosity going and allowing people to get to know, the different people that you find of interest to pull onto your show.
Well, yeah, no, thank you again. I can't wait to get this out to everyone here. And so many thank yous that I will certainly be throwing your way. And I will certainly be sharing all the things that you're doing. I'll put all the links and whatnot on my website and make sure that I get the word out about everything that you're doing. And
thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you again. And we will talk soon. I'll let you know when this is ready to go out.
Okay, thank you very much. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkempo.com. Thank you.